Ferrari and McLaren. Two Formula One teams founded by passionate racers. To drive for one of them is an honour. To drive for both is extraordinary. Derek Bell did just that.
I mean, it was just absolutely phenomenal. The biggest surprise, and I never had confidence in myself. I never felt that I was able to do that. But you're right. I mean, I was in Formula 3 for 2 years and had my first Formula 2 race. And two races later, I'm signed up by Ferrari. I mean, I don't know how that happened.
Derek was personally chosen by the great Enzo Ferrari, and he made his debut, of all places, at the team's home race. Beyond Formula One, he showed his talent behind the wheel of sports cars, winning the Le Mans 24 Hours 5 times. And he was seen on the big screen with Hollywood icon Steve McQueen.
I didn't know he'd done so much racing. To me, he was just an actor, and he was a bloody good driver. I got on with him, so I liked him a lot. But, you know, you drift apart after a couple of years. He wrote to me 3 weeks before he died, you know. I got a letter from him saying that he'd been ill and that sort of thing. I didn't think he was that ill. It was amazing, really.
Here on F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, Derek takes me through a hugely successful and diverse racing career that spanned more than 40 years. Derek tells me what it was like racing for Ferrari, going out for dinner with Enzo, and even seeing the softer side of the often unemotional founder of the Scuderia. Derek also compares his time in Formula One to his stellar sports car career, his formidable partnership with fellow F1 driver Jackie Ickx, and how it felt sharing a podium with his son Justin at Le Mans 30 years ago. And decades before F1 the movie, Derek reveals what it was like taking motorsport to the movies with Steve McQueen. Well, Derek, it is great to have you on the show. How are things?
Hectic, actually. It's so strange. But, I mean, my life is very calm overall. Bloody marvellous, really. We've just been away on a Derek Bell tour with V Management. We drove through Croatia, Slovenia, a little bit of Italy, a little bit of Austria. And here we are back.
Well, that tour sounds amazing. But we're here to talk about your career. It was an extraordinary one that spanned Formula One, lots of sports car successes as well, including those 5 wins at Le Mans. What are you most proud of when you look back at everything you've achieved?
I don't know that I ever think I'm proud of anything at all. So far, I would say the most important thing was to have had an amazing career, raced from Formula Ford to Formula One, to sports cars, to Can-Am, to everything, raced with the greatest drivers in the world, and actually not really ever have a major accident. And I think, you know, which has allowed me to carry on. Although I did flip the car at Daytona and the banking when a tire blew in the night, but it took off for a little while. So that was, I think, overall, you know, just a wonderful career driving with so many great people in the greatest teams in the world. And wasn't I lucky? I mean, really, for 40 years.
You talk about the greatest teams in the world. Can we start by talking about Ferrari and how you got there? Because you won your first Formula 3 race in 1966. And 2 years later, you were making your Formula 1 debut at Monza in a Ferrari. Can you join the dots for us?
Well, at the time, it was extremely difficult to join the dots. It was just so, oh, really? Oh, right, I'll go and do that then. And I mean, it was just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the biggest surprise, and I never had confidence in myself. I never felt that I was able to do that. I mean, honestly, now I look at it and I go, actually, I didn't have a bad career. Other people like your good self are picking it up and saying, do you realize this? And I didn't realize at the time. I mean, to me, I was really disappointed I didn't move on quicker. But you're right. I mean, I was in Formula 3 for two years and had my first Formula 2 race. And 2 races later, I'm signed up by Ferrari. I mean, I don't know how that happened. And I didn't think it was right that I should have got the drive. But and then you go, yes, but you qualified 8th place next to Jackie Stewart on the 3rd row of the grid in your first Grand Prix at Monza. And you go, yeah, I did. And I now I reflect on it, I realize how amazingly fortunate I was.
Can we talk about how you got there? Can you remember the first time you met Enzo Ferrari?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, who couldn't? Wasn't I lucky? You know, and sometimes I look at that I met him and went out with him, and he used to take me out to dinner. He'd turn up in a 2+2 at the hotel, and they'd have phoned me and said, El Commando Torre is taking you out to dinner tonight. And he would turn up at 6:15, and he'd be sitting there in his, as we say, braces, English. And I'd get in the passenger seat, and we'd tear off sort of 40, 50 miles away for dinner. And on one occasion, we walked in, and he actually opened the door for me to go into the restaurant. Now, that is amazing.
He must have really liked you.
It wasn't the first... Well, I think he did have a bit of extra emotion having an Englishman. I don't know why.
Does that go back to the Peter Collins and his relationship with him, maybe?
That's right. I mean, I remember I walked into my parents' house. I'd been to see my then wife in hospital. My mother stood there with a gin and tonic in her hand, and next to her was my wife's, at that time, mother. And she said, there's a note here from Ferrari saying, please come to Maranello and sign your contract. And she said, if you go off and sign for Ferrari, you'll never walk in this house again. It's pretty mean stuff. And my mother was the most generous, fabulous person. But people were having such horrific accidents. And I think my mother just, you know, bit the bullet and had a go at me. It didn't have any effect, mind you.
You still signed the contract.
Yes, I went out and signed my contract. And ever after that, she was okay with it. Never said another word.
Derek, I am interested in why Enzo Ferrari wanted you. Because at that time, Ferrari had a sports car team. It had Formula One team, Formula Two team. He kind of had the choice of any driver he wanted. And you'd been plucked. Okay, you were winning in Formula 3
and
in 66 and 2.
And 2, really,
but why,
in the initial.
Why you?
I think he liked British drivers. And I think he saw something. I mean, I always wonder where they see you from. You know, and people have said, but I think they look at you the season before and see how you're getting on. And I believe he watched me in Formula 3 when I finished third in 67 at Monaco behind the works mattress. And Monaco, I suppose, is because that's where all the Formula One teams are the same weekend, and their spotters go and see how well you're getting on. That had to be something that put me in his favour, really. I was the most successful British driver in Europe that year. And it was a hell of a lot of good drivers, but I was just one of them. And I guess somehow the old man thought that, you know, I was ready for his team. And I don't know that I was. I felt that I felt I went to Ferrari too soon. I hadn't done enough in Formula 2 when I went there. I mean, they put me in my first race at Monza and I got pole. And then we had a crash in the race and took 3 cars out.
Why do you think you weren't ready? What was different about Ferrari back then? Was it extra pressure?
I didn't feel any pressure at all because I went in there mid-season. And I mean, and obviously I went quite well. I guess I didn't know I was going to get pole at Monza. I didn't know that I was going to win in Austria. I didn't know I was going to win at Zandvoort in those first 4 races. That was quite important to me to sort of have those victories in a Ferrari. I never thought about it as, wow, aren't I good? It was like, God, I wish I could win more, you know. And then, of course, came the chance to drive Formula One. I did the Alton Park Gold Cup to start with and qualified, I think, next to Jackie Stewart. Might have been on a third rail or something like that. And, of course, we had a problem with the gearbox, which I had several times in very important races when I used to go across the box too fast and jam it between 2 gears. And I did that at Zandvoort. I did that in Alton Park. And it was what Phil Hill did several times, they told me. And we were just too smooth across the box. Do you know what I mean?
Ah, the days of, you know...
Shifting gear, you mean?
Shifting gear without just pressing a button.
That's right, yeah.
You mentioned Phil Hill. He told me once that Ferrari always believed that his cars won races and drivers lost them. Can you relate to that from your experiences?
I never heard that one, but I think he's right in many ways. If you had the best car on the grid and you didn't win it, then you must have screwed up. But the fact was, he really had the choice, not talking about me, but generally speaking, of the great. He always had great drivers, didn't he? But I think they tried to do too much. They had Formula 2, then he went and Formula One and hill climbing. And of course, they were doing Can-Am. And I personally, when you look at the small operation, although they could build engines, it it didn't mean they could test. I mean, the testing program was minimal. Chris Amon was, I thought, a great test driver, but maybe I was wrong, but I believe he was. So Chris would test it and we'd all go and drive it, and that was the par for the weekend. I didn't know, I couldn't say, that was awful, Chris, because I didn't ever test it. That came later on.
Can you describe Maranello to us in the late 60s?
Well, it was Mecca, wasn't it, really?
Well, it still is, in a way.
It still is, yes. No, but I mean, you look at the size of it now, but it was so small then. I mean, you drove down this road and pulled over, and you go, well, the Ferrari's on the left. Okay, and that's the restaurant on the right.
And, Il Cavallino.
I remember parking on the grass. I thought, I daren't drive through the gates. I was in an E-Type. I thought, I can't.
Because you were in the E-Type, you didn't want to drive through?
No, the old man will throw it out if I drive through with an E-Type. It's very early on, this is. And so I left it on the grass. And then they all came out for their sort of afternoon coffee break, or they went to lunch or something. And suddenly the factory empties, and they're all surrounding my little E-Type. We had the bonnet up and everything, you know, sort of checking it out. They couldn't believe it, because the old man really believed that was a really great car. He had a lot of time for the E-Type.
Tell me a little more about Enzo. Was he an intimidating character? You've already said that he was opening doors for you occasionally, but when he spoke, you listen. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And also, what language did you communicate?
Well, it's in French. Yeah, we spoke French together. And I wasn't very good, and nor was he.
But good enough to talk numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I never dealt financials with him, you know. I mean, it was a Gotsi that we spoke with. The numbers weren't very good when you think. I got $1,000 for a Grand Prix and $500 for Formula 2 race back in 68.
Fast forward to 2025, yeah. it's a little more now, isn't it?
We didn't get loaned a car or anything. I had a bloody Fiat 124 from Hertz. It was hilarious, really.
So let's now fast forward to Monza 68, all right? You know him from Formula 2. You've got the call. I want you to do the Italian Grand Prix. Were you nervous? Describe what it was like during the build-up to that Grand Prix for you, your Grand Prix debut.
I had a test drive. I've got a picture on my phone, actually, of the test drive picture of me sitting in the Formula One car for the first time ever at the test track, as it was in those days.
So was Fiorano, around?
No, I didn't know where that was. No, we were in the park. There was nothing, just grass and trees, and you drove around it as we did in many places, and that was it, you know. And I remember sitting in the car, and it was raining, and we didn't have wet tires, we had intermediates, and they were sort of not very special, because the Formula One cars were just coming back from the German Grand Prix, then got back. It was like the Tuesday morning. So I was there testing, raining like hell, and Figuri leans in as he does up the seatbelts. We'd never had seatbelts till then. He leans in the cockpit and he says, Derek, if you crash the car, the last time you ever drive a red car, maybe a green car, but never a red car. And with that, he finished pulling up the belts and I went off on the track. And I drove off. It was long grass, everyone. I'd been on the track before, obviously, only about a kilometre around. As I come through on my first lap, there was quite a fast left-hand corner of this little chicane. And as I sort of went into this fast corner, there is a 2+2 sitting on the outside of the corner on the concrete, not actually on my bit of the road, 20 yards away, with the old man sitting in it, watching his new driver go around. And I thought, oh my God, how do I drive now? I mean, do I drive super quick and fall off? Or do I drive sort of steadily? And then he goes, oh, he's a bit slow. I really didn't know what to do. And then at the end of it all, of course, they call me in and Enzo drove off. Never heard any more about it. But it was a pretty terrifying moment. But I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it? You know, the boss has to go and see his new prodigy. And then they said, okay, you'll drive at the Gold Cup and Alton Park first. And that's when I had this problem with it jamming in gear. I don't even know where I finished. Obviously, I had to lose most of a lap.
This episode is sponsored by Babbel. As we head into the final stretch of 2025, a lot of us start thinking about what we want to tick off before the year's out. It's a great time to set a personal goal and make the end of the year one to be proud of. For me, learning something new always feels like a good investment, and picking up a new language is right up there. It opens doors to new experiences, new cultures, and even new friendships. And with Babbel, you can start that journey today. Babbel's conversation-based method teaches you phrases and words you'll actually use day to day, because learning a new language is so much more than just ordering a coffee and asking for directions. It's about giving you confidence in new situations, and Babbel makes it fun. It even tailors lessons to professional scenarios that you might need in the workplace, which can help boost career opportunities and connections. I know if I needed to brush up for a work trip or impress a client, I'd trust Babbel to get me up to speed. And what I really like is how Babbel keeps you motivated with progress trackers and real-time feedback. It's like having your own private language coach in your pocket. And with over a dozen languages to choose from, including French, Spanish, Italian, and German, you can pick the one that suits your goals best. And right now, Babbel is offering our listeners up to 60% off their subscription. Go to babbel.com/grid to claim your discount. That's babbel.com/grid for up to 60% off. Valid for a limited time only. Babbel, language learning that works. This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low impact motion. And I don't need to second guess my progress, because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID. You line up eighth on the grid at Monza, your Grand Prix debut. You've got Jackie Stewart on one side, you've got Denny Hulme on the other. What was the establishment like with you as the newcomer? And I sort of am reminded of this story that Michael Schumacher always used to go and welcome the new guys. Guys, I hope you have a good race. Remember me when you see my helmet type thing. What were they like with you?
Nobody's ever asked me that before. A long time ago to remember back. I remember my mechanic was very enthusiastic, lovely guy. Morelli, I think his name was Morelli. And he was just charming and just making sure I was comfortable. I mean, the performance they went through to make the seat comfortable, the leather was almost the right color for you. Everything was right when they put you. I mean, you felt really important sitting in the race shop, getting lined up to go to a race in the car, and how they tailored it for you. They were wonderful. I mean, in that beautiful, you know, red-tiled workshop, which I guess they still have, it was very special. You felt a very privileged person to be driving a Ferrari.
And did Enzo say anything after the race to you?
No.
Not a word?
No. Basically, I didn't live in Maranello or anything like that. I came back to England. My wife at that time had been very poorly in England. And I used to walk in, I'd get called into the office from wherever I was. You know, Commander Torrey wants to see you. So I'd go into the office. The first thing he'd say is, how is your wife today? Because she was in hospital in England. He said, how is your wife today? And I said, well, I haven't spoken to her yet. Well, it was obviously 9 o'clock where we were. But obviously in England, it was only 8. And I said, it's too early to worry the hospital. So he got his secretary always to phone up the hospital to check how my wife was.
That's great insight into the softer side of Enzo
Ferrari. It was
the
family side of nearly all Italians. They're like that. And after that first Grand Prix, which was another story, you know, seeing Chris fly over the bloody guardrail backwards right in front of me, I thought, well, that's it. I thought, well, at least, because remember, I'd stopped with the engine failing. And I mean, Chris came through in third place behind the Hondas, Ginther and Surtees, and suddenly disappeared off the Lesmos backwards over the guardrail, through the trees, and that was it. I went, oh, he's dead already. I mean, the beginning of the year, Jimmy Clark, he'd died in the first race that year for me. And here I was at Monza in my first bloody Formula One race, and there is my teammate going backwards over into the woods. And I thought, well, that's it. And I honestly thought, and he didn't appear for a while, and I thought, well, at least I can tell my son that, you know, I had at that point a year old or something, I can tell my son that I got to a Formula One and then I quit. And I said, because I'm going to quit. I can't be doing it, you know, people dying like that. And the next thing is Chris comes up dusting himself off like dust everywhere, brushing it off, and caught back across the road. And it was just amazing. And so that had a major effect on me and made me closer to Ferrari, probably. I mean, it landed basically upside down, and then he got out. Literally, we saw it in the factory the next day. There was a little dent in the monocoque. That's all that existed from this crash. I mean, it was just amazing. But, you know, there was no great dramas about it or anything. I mean, it was just an accident.
One of the things you said right at the start of this chat was that you raced at the top level for more than 40 years and you walked away. What were you like in 68? Because you've just made reference to it. Your first, if you like, international race was the F2 race in which Jimmy Clark was killed at Hockenheim. I'd like to know the impact that had on you.
That had a massive effect on me, whereas Chris Amon's accident didn't, because he didn't get hurt. So, you know, you strike it off. No, Jimmy's was terrible because he was my hero. I admired him and I'd just seen him race at Goodwood and places like that and other circuits. And he was just unique's not the right word, but a very special driver in my life as far as, you know, the impact he had on my racing and how he handled himself. And the same with Stirling, really. I mean, I had the same feelings about him. But, and also they were British, which I think made you feel closer. And they were both very friendly to younger drivers. But I hadn't met Jimmy really till the night before the race he had, to be honest. But it had a lot of effect on me, you know, and I don't know, I just felt I had to really think seriously about it. Did I want to put my family through the stuff that I was seeing around me? But I never thought I'd quit at that point because the car was very good.
A couple more Formula One races I wanted to ask you about. First of all, Watkins Glen 68, your second one. How much notice did the old man at Ferrari give you ahead of that? Was it always in your contract that you were going to do that one, or do you get the nod the week before? How does it work?
No, I just got the nod when Jackie Ickx had hurt his ankle or something in Canada, and they said, you know, Derek, you're driving up Watkins Glen. I never thought anything about it, so I'd never been to the Glen. Oh, I remember we learned it. We all got on golf carts. I went out with all the drivers, and we were racing golf carts sort of up and down the hills at Watkins Glen, and we all got a big bollocking for it. It was hilarious from the guys at the golf club, but nobody turned the cart over. But it was the first time I'd had camaraderie, because at first, you know, Monza was very different, and then suddenly there you are at you know, the United States Grand Prix. And but the important thing about that was they wouldn't let me do any laps, and they kept holding me back. They let me go out two laps and in. I was going, well, how pointless is this? Go out and try these new brake pads, two laps, three laps and in. Ickx wasn't there because he'd had the accident at Canada, so it just left Chris and me. Chris obviously was in the points. It was penultimate race of the World Championship, something like that. There's no way I was going to feature. And all they did was make sure that I drove very well, didn't get in the way of anybody. And this certainly didn't hold any of the drivers up in the Ferrari team. So that's really what it was for. But they wanted, obviously, they had the seat, so why not use it? It was so frustrating because I'd do one lap and they'd basically do the next lap and they'd call me in and I hadn't done a timed lap. And I go, she's driving me insane. But they didn't want me. I remember them saying, we do not want you getting in the way of Amon, who's at the front, because he could win the world championship. You know, that's it. So that's all I remember really with that race. And in the race, I did quite a reasonable job. But I mean, It wasn't that good.
That was your last Grand Prix for Ferrari.
Yeah, now, I did one more race, but that was the last. I did Silverstone Dead Express Trophy.
Okay, non-championship.
In the rain, yeah.
Non-championship. Yeah. But now, what about, if I say a four-wheel drive McLaren to you, the M9A, following year, you're at Silverstone. Now, there were actually other four-wheel drive cars in that race, all of them behind you.
All, yeah.
But what was it like to drive?
Bloody awful. It was horrible. It was absolutely, it was hideous, really. Enzo pulled out of racing. Suddenly, all the drivers are out on the loose. I mean, unbelievable. Just, that's it, lads. So, and of course, I was never on a retainer, so I wouldn't do any more racing, so I didn't get any more money. And that was it. Never spoke to the old man. I spoke to him a few years later, but never then. And that was it. So I went home to him, and I thought, well, that's great. And that's when I thought I was not really very good, because I was out in the cold. I had no drive for next year. And I'm going, well, what the hell do I do? You know, my time with dear old Tom Wheatcroft had, you know, sort of really helped my career. I hadn't come to anything at that point. I hadn't met Tom. We've just, because I met him on the Tasman series the first year I went. And I'm going to have to call old Tom, because he said, anytime you want any help, lad, I'll give me a call. I thought, I think I need his help now. But that was another story, obviously, where we went and how we made, actually, it all made good. To leave Ferrari, that was awful. And then, so 69 was a pretty lean year. I didn't have any drives that I'm aware of, which was thanks to Ferrari. So in a way, I was a bit disappointed, you might say. And that's when I started to lose confidence that I was really any good. But I felt, well, I might be nearly as quick as Chris. I was nearly as quick as Jackie Stewart, but I wasn't. You know, they were still quicker. Then you put into picture that, you know, they've been racing a lot longer and they've been racing at this level a lot longer, so they should be better.
But and how fickle is this sport, or was this sport back then? And was one good result enough to get people ringing you, asking you to race for them?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it didn't happen for me, but Bruce McLaren did phone. But it was only because he had wanted the new car run, and I didn't know much about it at all. I never even heard of four-wheel drive on that car. I mean, I knew of it because Peter Westbury had four-wheel drives, but... And I thought, well, you know, what's going to happen next? And then out of the blue, I get this call from Bruce. And he said, you know, what are you doing next weekend? He said, I've tested the car at Goodwood. I mean, it just shows how stupid it was. Tested the car at Goodwood. It runs okay. Would you like to run at the British Grand Prix? I don't think many guys would have taken the opportunity. I've got to be driving something I can really prove that I'm good. But I was happy to drive anything. So,
first time you drove that car was in... First practice at Silverstone, yeah, for the British Grand Prix.
I guess on the Friday.
What was it like? I guess traction was good, being four-wheel drive.
Yes, traction was good, but it's very difficult unless you've driven another Formula One car around Silverstone, and I hadn't. If I'd got out of the two-wheel drive car and got in the four-wheel drive, I'm sure I'd have noticed a difference, but I just didn't in the car because I'd never driven anything like it in my life, and it wasn't very good. The principle we thought was that you could get into the corner quicker. And I was inclined to agree. I felt that you could really get closer to the grass verge because you could go into the corner faster. But the car weaved about. And when you analyze it, it was very obvious what the problem was. There were no electronics. So as you brake for the corner, let's say you're getting a 60-40 braking reaction, like that, as you come down, hang a straight into the right-hander, which only take a dab of the brakes. But when you did that, the engine would then slow you down as you drop down a gear. That would have a different sort of braking force on the wheels. That would have all four slowing down at the rate of like that. But the brakes were trying to give you another percentage or whatever it was. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that nobody had done that yet. When we get electric, you know, we get cars with all the latest tech that we have now. Of course, they can dial it in and each one has to be mutually respectful of the other, you know, the four-wheel drive and the braking system, so you don't get that awful change.
Was it hairy to drive?
It just didn't really do what you wanted. I thought I could go in, get right out to the edge and turn in, but because, I don't know, it was because of the way it slowed down, it wasn't stable. I mean, it just wasn't a stable car. And I remember coming in and I said, I need some wing on this. Could I have a wing? Because Bruce, or whoever it was, had decided that they'd run their cars without any wings. And of course, because, you know, Silverstone was so damn fast. And I thought, well, that was a bloody good idea. But of course, I had this sort of shovel thing on the back of the car in its first state. And I thought, you know, I need more than this on the car, because the car isn't stable going in. You kept thinking, I want the car to get firmer going into the corner. But they thought the all-wheel drive would do it, but it wouldn't, possibly because of what I just mentioned.
But also, aerodynamics were in their infancy at the time,
yeah,
weren't they? So maybe they just didn't fully understand what aero could do for you.
No.
But Derek, it must have been a really interesting time to have been in racing, right? You've got McLaren trying four-wheel drive. As I said, aerodynamics are in their infancy and going on leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
The six-wheel Tyrrell was to come along a few years later. Was it an exciting time? Did you feel the innovation all around you?
Oh, yeah, very definitely.
Right, last race I want to talk to you about was your most successful one in Formula One. The Watkins Glen 1970, you finish in the points, driving for John Surtees, who was still racing at the time.
That's right.
He was the player manager.
That's right, yeah. I think I mentioned Tom Wheatcroft just now. And Tom came into the picture because we met my old man who was on a booze cruise the whole time on the Tasman series. 7 weekends, 7 races, absolutely fabulous, and great fun people, and lapping up the Europeans coming over to race in their countries. And Tom was over there just because I'll come over and look at the cars, and, you know, he loved racing cars. And I'd never heard of him, but he was there, and my stepfather, the Colonel, as we called him, he was there, and they both liked their, you know, whiskey and waters at night. And they were great characters, both the same sort of size, and loved racing. And, of course, Tom became a close friend of my stepfather and mine. And, of course, when it came to the end of the year, actually, Tom said to me, any time you need any help, lad, give me a call. Well, it wasn't long before I needed help, because I didn't realize my racing career was going to disappear at the end of that year. Funnily enough, across there just now was Mike Earle. And Mike Earle was working with me with my Formula 2 team, Church Farm Racing. And if you remember, we ran the McLaren for Peter Gethin. You probably don't, but we ran it in Formula 5000. When I went to Ferrari, Peter came along and said to our team, because we were quite obviously showing a bit of promise as a little setup, would we run the McLaren Formula 5000 car? And I've got this wonderful painting of Peter at Goodwood in the Formula 5000 McLaren. They went over to America, and I know they won the race at, not Sears Point, but something like that. Peter won the Can-Am race, or the 5000 race, in a McLaren. And that wouldn't have ever been my car. I think Peter just had an in with McLaren when I went to Ferrari. So we continued on, and so that was that. And then, of course, the old man came on the Tasman series and met up with Tom, and then afterwards we cultivated Tom into sort of helping us out, and he wanted to do that. He loved it. But the sad thing was that he had lost a certain interest in doing it. I think he... because probably my stepfather wasn't so involved anymore. But so Tom helped me out all through that year and financed my racing. But I mean,
so what year are we talking?
70, aren't I?
70, right. I've been told that Tom Wheatcroft's love of the sport suffered massively when Roger Williamson died.
Oh, definitely.
At Zandvoort.
Oh, no, definitely, definitely. Yeah. No, definitely. But he helped me so much. Well, I mean, he said, I'll help you, lad. And I said, what do you mean? He said, no, you want the money, you know. But the strangest thing was, I mean, you know, Tom's not around anymore, but at the end of that year, he then sort of phoned me one day and he said, hey, lad, you owe me some money, you know. And I said, what do you mean? You borrowed the money to go racing. I said, Tom, I nearly cried. I said, I never would have ever earned enough money to pay you back. You said you wanted a sponsor. And as far as I was concerned, we never had a legal battle. But it soured our relationship, and I adored Tom. I mean, he was one of those people you couldn't fail but like and love because of his passion. And he did help me. I mean, he helped me immensely. But unfortunately, you know, almost remember, I'd been at Ferrari before that, so my career was starting to take a bit of a downward trend, which wasn't very much fun.
So how did the opportunity with Surtees come about?
At the end of that next year, when we were running the Brabham with Tom, in discussion, he said, why don't we do the Tasman series? I'll buy the Brabham that Jackie Ickx drove in the German Grand Prix, Formula One car, BT26, I believe. And so Tom had bought that car, and he stuck that V8 in the back of it. Now, the problem is that V8 had been round the mill a few times. That had been used by Lotus. Chapman had used it and done the Tasman series and Formula One. So Tom had this engine, and it always ran, but it was never that special. But it was obviously an early one, and he wasn't prepared to update it or whatever it required. And so that's what we drove with, and that's really what I had in the back of the Surtees TS7 that day. He gave that engine to John Surtees to run in the United States Grand Prix. I was actually running all right. I was running in the race behind Rainer Wiesel, and I'd caught him up in the works Lotus. And then I went to go by, and then I felt this vibration in the engine. So I slowed down and thought, God, Derek, you've got to finish a race in Formula One. I hadn't finished really well at all. So I said, I've got to finish. So I cut back 1,000 revs, which of course takes a load off it, but I've got to finish it. So I backed off, and I know, and Rennie went on to finish third, yet I'd been catching him up, and I think I'd have beaten him. So I could have had a third that day, but didn't.
Still in the points.
Yes, right. We got in. I got my 1 point.
And what was John like, John Surtees, player manager? I said already, you know, he was still driving at the time. Was he very involved in your car, or was he more focused on what he was driving?
That's a very good question. He and I weren't close friends at that point. We were just racing colleagues. You know, it was a one-off that I was doing with him, although we had talked about trying to think of the future and had long meetings with him about going on for the future. But John said, I can't help Derek at all in the future, but he said, I will put him in the Formula 5000 car and I'll run him in that if that's what he would like to do. And to me at that stage, it was a retrograde step. To go Formula 5000 in England was like it's a super sports, a sportsman's division. It wasn't public. No, you know, there were no star drivers in it. I mean, Mike Hellwood did it, but Mike was, you know, coming out of bike racing as well. And he did a hell of a job. He won the championship. You know, I'd been up to Formula One. I didn't want to sort of drop back to a lower league. So I didn't do it again.
Well, 1970 is when you did your first Le Mans for Ferrari. Ronnie Peterson was your teammate.
Yeah.
It feels like that was a pivotal moment for you in your career. Did you immediately fall in love with sports car racing?
Yes, I did. I got the opportunity to drive at Spa before Le Mans for Jack Swatters. And Jack Swatters I'd met on the Tasman series. But I always preferred single-seaters. I mean, always and today. There's something unbelievable about that. It's not the danger side of it. It's just what it is. It's bloody Formula One. You know, it's just special. Sports cars is great, but it's not got the same kudos as Formula One. But I wasn't about to get back to Formula One, although I didn't know that I was going to be wasting my time with Techno like a year later. But, you know, which you may confirm the fact that Formula One wasn't the way to go. But driving, you know, for Ferrari at Le Mans was special. Then to drive at Kyalami for him was special. Well, that was for Jack, obviously, but in the Ferrari. And at Spa, too. But Spa was a hell of a race. I mean, we put on a hell of a show that day.
And that was the old Spa. And I think Pedro Rodriguez still has the fastest ever lap of Spa, even today, from that year.
Well, actually, the year later. Because I drove for Porsche there the next year, Spa. And I got pole at 161 mile an hour around the old Spa, quicker than Pedro and Joe. And in the race, Seppi wasn't as quick as Pedro. Because I'd put the car on pole, I thought David York or whoever would think that we were in the position to win because we'd won Buenos Aires, we'd lost at Daytona, we'd lost at Sebring. It was our turn to win. And that seemed to be the way they were working. They will alternate who wins which, when, where. So when I did Spa and got pole, I thought, well, they'll help me win the race. But they didn't. And I was so disappointed. And they told me to stick in the position. Joe was leaning over the guardrail and calling me on. And David York was saying, hold your position.
Being at Le Mans, having success almost immediately in sports cars, that must have done a lot for your confidence.
Yeah.
And you knew then, okay, he'd taken a slightly different path, but here's to the next, you know, 30-odd years at the top.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had such mixed emotions. I'd had such a great time getting up to that level. And it's funny, it's like going through school. You end up in the first 15. When you're up there, you're on cloud nine. But if you have to step back and then try and do it again, it's never, it doesn't sort of work the same way. And nothing else substitutes for that emotion you had at the top, if that's not that I was ever at the top, but driving for a team like Ferrari. You know, because then the next thing, as I say, I was driving for Tecno, which was...
How different then was the atmosphere in the Ferrari sports car team compared to the F1 team? Because this was the halcyon era of Ferrari versus Ford and Porsche.
That's right.
You know, was it very different in the Ferrari sports car team?
Yeah. Oh, very much. You didn't feel Enzo was part of it at all. But I'm sure he was. It was very much a dealer thing, the dealer involvement in the sports car program. Because you had Maranello concessionaires in Britain had a car. Pozzi in Paris had a car. The Americans had a car for the, you know, their dealer network there. But at Le Mans, they didn't always have quite so many of them getting that involved.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low-impact motion. And I don't need to second-guess my progress because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID.
Now, you had some wonderful teammates in sports car racing. Ronnie, we've spoken about, was 1970. You won three of your Le Mans with Jackie Ickx, Stefan Beloff as well. Tell us about those guys. I mean, Ronnie, first of all, he was still very young, very raw in 1970. Mm. It was his first season of Formula One racing.
Yeah.
What stood out about his talent? Can you remember?
Ronnie, me, and Peter Gethin had a test drive for Porsche. The end of, it must have been the Formula 2 year, John Wire had a test day with Gulf at Goodwood. And I've always died to know what times we did back then. And the three of us came along to do a test drive, and I got the drive. And I'm never quite sure why, because I always felt Ronnie was better. But then, in the typical DB way, I analyze it and go, well, Ronnie really wanted to be in Formula One, so he wasn't going to put his efforts into sports car. And then Pete Gethin, he had a lot of interests, and nobody quite knew which way he was headed. So, as far as I was concerned, I guess that's how I got the drive. I was like, well, better have Derek Bell then. But I don't know what they really thought. And I asked John Horseman, the manager, 5 years ago, probably more now. Because I was itching to know what our times were. I'd love to know.
You were never told.
Never told. But more than anything, I was just wanting to know the times that we did round Goodwood. I wasn't interested whether I was quicker. I assumed I was. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got the drive.
Jackie Ickx.
Yes.
You were a phenomenal partnership, the two of you. Why were you so successful together? And what stood out about Jackie?
Well, I admired Jackie ever since I knew him at Ferrari, but I didn't know him. I just respected him. He was this young lad that had come out of Belgium, got from motorbikes or scramblers or whatever, or train, you know, mountain stuff. Everybody respected him. Everybody had such a high regard for him. It was absolutely astonishing. And I did too. I never got to know him at Ferrari. I did that first race with him. And I think I did a Formula 2 meeting with him somewhere. But he was never super friendly. He was okay. And I didn't... But I just
competitive rivalry. Is that why he wasn't super friendly?
I'm sure he did, yeah. Yeah. But he knew, in my opinion, that to win he had to be insular. He had to do his own thing and do it Jackie Ickx's way. He didn't need to get friends with me. However, we became the greatest friends probably in motorsport eventually. But that was different by then. We were both more mature. And I'd proved to him I wasn't crashing, blowing up or whatever the car. And, I mean, we had a faultless time together, really. We never really had a problem breaking down or went off the road. Neither of us ever went off the road.
Implicit trust in each other. Is that what made you so good together?
Had to be, yeah. He'd come in and say, I think we should do this on the car. I'd say, okay, let's do it. The car was so good that you couldn't really criticize it. You know, I mean, we changed things. But, you know, and I remember saying one day, I said, I think we should just go a bit further on that rear roll bar, you know, just try up another half an inch. And he said, do you really think so? I said, well, let's try it. And Porsche were very keen to try anything we wanted to. I mean, they just wanted us to be happy. But you never really got any feedback for them. And Norbert was great because, although that is Porsche, but he would say, if you want to change it, change it. I don't think it'll work, but, you know, that's what I loved about Norbert Singer. You know, not let it be on your head, it is. It wasn't. It was like, if you want to try it, try it.
And you and Ickx won together at Le Mans for the first time in 75. What was it like in those days? You've just been two drivers doing 12 hours each. Are the parties outrageous afterwards back then, or are you too exhausted?
Oh, no. Well, I must admit, the parties at Le Mans were a little bit quiet. I mean, I had to go down on the table, you know, you're ready. But no, I mean, they weren't wild. I don't know. Jackie was such a professional. And when you did it, you knew you'd done your best. We never, ever really discussed, we should have done this, we should have done that. I mean, you know, I'd say, why don't we change that? And he said, if you want to, try it. You know, Norbert would say the same. We'd both go the same way. And the car was so bloody good, that was the point.
Well, all of those Porsches were so bloody good.
Yeah, I mean, the 917 was something unique because I'd never driven a sports car like that in my life. And we just did the one race and they'd set it up to what it was. And I mean, maybe we did change the rear wing a fraction of an inch. Norbert was such the most astonishing man to work with. And that was his baby. And they knew from the experience the year before, it's a very, very fast track. So you don't want to lose some part of the handling in favor of, you know, sort of gaining a bit of downforce. It was very finely tuned, that car. It was phenomenal.
Did you have a favorite Porsche? Because then, of course, you get the 956 and the 962.
Mm. No, I mean, I wouldn't say the 917 was my favorite. To me, the one I really loved was the 936. I only drove it that once. Never sat in it in my life. Get in and go quicker than I've ever been before around Le Mans. And
what year was that?
81. Yeah, and then 82 we won with the 956, and 83 we won with the 962, I think. But I know for some reason I loved that Jules car. It was so elegant. It was a fabulous car, and it handled like a dream, as any Porsche would. And that's all I knew.
Now, I did also want to ask you about Stefan Beloff.
Yeah.
Because so much has been made in recent history of the Mercedes Young Driver Program. You know, that Michael Schumacher, Heinz Helfrich, and all those guys came up through in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Porsche had sort of set up the precursor to that, I felt, with someone like Beloff. I mean, he was blindingly quick.
Yes,
he
was.
Won with him.
Yes.
How good was he?
He was exceptionally good. And obviously had a great future.
In Formula One?
Anything but Formula One, yes. But I never saw him in Formula One. I didn't. So I didn't study him. I mean, he never showed to me that he was exceptional. But you're going to say, well, yeah, but he was 2 seconds quicker than his teammate in the other works car. I don't, or whatever car it was. I don't remember. I just know forever abiding memory of him is that he was so fast. He was such a lovely lad, and I was very fond of him, and I just wish I'd talked to him about trying to be a little bit more sober-minded with his driving.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think he overdrove.
Was he too impatient?
No. I think he just thought he could go quicker all the time, not impatience. And it always bothers me that he was allowed to go quicker and quicker. But at the Nürburgring that year, he crashed, not when he died, but we were leading the race. I'd never won the Nürburgring. Every car, pole position, lap records, all that sort of thing, but could never bloody win. I even led it on the last lap twice in a sports car and in Formula 2, and the bloody engine went or something broke. And so the Nürburgring was very hard for me to win, and only won when they put the new track on there, and of course Beloff and I go and win. Well, I felt very strongly that he should have been guided a little bit more by the people above. I don't mean up there, but I mean at our level.
People point to the Monaco Grand Prix in 1984, the one where Senna was gaining on Prost when they cut the race short.
Yeah.
What not so many people know is that Beloff was gaining on Senna in the wet.
Yeah. Well, that figures.
A mercurial talent.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything points to
exactly.
that, doesn't it? Is it true that he called you father?
Yeah. Well, one way or the other, with father and son, yeah. I had great teammates. I was so lucky to have phenomenal teammates. And of course, it reflects in the fact that I won a lot of races, but it was them, really. I just didn't make a mistake and fall off the road. But I'm just concerned that Beloff, he shouldn't have died. He shouldn't have been allowed to die. He shouldn't have been given the chance to overdrive. That day, not the year he died, the year before, at the Nürburgring. And I remember I literally went across to somebody in the Porsche team and I said, why don't you just get him to back off? Take it easy. We were like, 4 minutes in the lead, 7 laps to go, whatever it was. It was just, don't cruise, but we all have a mode that we can drive at. But why go faster every lap?
Did you say that to him?
Not to Beloff. I wish I had. But it wasn't down to me to say that. Somebody should have taken him to one side. Look, old son, you're bloody fast. Look at your times. They're wonderful. The reason Ix and I won so much is because we knew how fast to go to win. And that's what you need, isn't it?
Sort of Fangio win at the slowest possible speed.
Almost, but we, yes.
Now, you had some phenomenal teammates at Le Mans. Peterson, we've talked about. Beloff, we've talked about. Ix, we've talked about. Joseph, Jaboui, Jarier, Stuck. You must have learnt off all of them.
Yeah.
When were you at your peak? You won your last Le Mans in 1987.
Yeah.
Do you think you were still at your peak then, or did it come earlier?
No, I think I was still on it then, yeah. I don't think it was any difference any year. I mean, the Beloff period, I mean, Jackie and I would do very comparable lap times, I believe. And, I was never told to go faster, which is always nice. He and I had the most amazing sort of time together.
I mean, you were still on the podium at Le Mans with your son Justin and Andy Wallace in 1995
yeah,
in that
and
McLaren.
I was quicker than they were. From what I get, I never looked
You're
into
that
it.
Competitive dad.
No. I just drove as fast as I could. And, but I got the joke. It was like we just put the old man in and he was so quick in the rain and that sort of thing.
But you were leading with, what, six hours to go, weren't
you?
Yeah,
I know. Really unbelievable.
I'm fascinated as to how you think age affected you as a driver, because in Formula One now, Lewis Hamilton's 40 and a half.
Yeah.
Alonso has just had his 44th birthday. I find it extraordinary that Alonso is still able to do the things he's able to do in a Formula One car.
Yeah.
How did age affect you?
I don't know. I don't think it really did. I think when I...
Do you lose something?
Well, it's so... I don't know. I don't think so. I think you lose the passion to do it or the desire to do it. But I mean,
if you can maintain that desire as Alonso can, there's no reason why you can't keep going.
It's just that it wears you out. The pressure that they're under in Formula One. We did 6 hour races every month, once or one or two a month. I never really totally agreed with having three drivers in the car. But I remember Jackie saying to me, we in 83, we need to have a third driver. I said, but who? He said, well, who can you think of? I said, there's nobody. that I would want to drive with, that I'd have the confidence that he could do what you were.
Did he feel the same way?
Well, we didn't get a third driver, so it must have had some effect. Jackie was a very sensitive bloke that he knew that we were working, doing really too much. It was too physical, too mental for two drivers.
By the mid-80s, there were, you know, ground effect was coming in on the cars. They must have been quite physical.
Yeah.
For 24 hours.
Yes, they were. But you ran less ground effect at Le Mans. We had the sort of the longer nose, and or slightly different nose, and then a slightly different sort of, ride heights and things like that to get the maximum pace out of it.
Did you ever worry at Le Mans, 250 mile an hour down the Mulsanne Straight? Mm. Did you ever worry about a tyre blowout or a failure at that speed?
No, because I didn't really ever see it.
No, so you didn't worry about that?
Not really, no. I mean, how could you go into 24 hours worrying about taking off? The thing is, I would if I drove for a lot of people, but I drove for Porsche, and I know how they built cars. And I saw the Norbert Singer, the way he worked on to make the cars good, which meant he was making them fast as well.
The great irony in all this is that the one time you hurt yourself at Le Mans was when you were filming the movie.
Yeah.
With Steve McQueen in 1970.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Yeah, that was, but it wasn't really racing. You know what I mean? It was
driving. But that's the great irony.
Yeah, well, I suppose you could, yeah, so it was worth it.
You do every Le Mans bar one from 1970 to 1996.
Yeah.
And you only injure yourself mucking around with Steve McQueen, no
less. That's right, yeah, yeah. But we weren't racing. That was one big difference. We were returning from a shot on the movie, and he said, I'm off. He said, I'm off. And he said, it was going back on the track the wrong way, absolutely flat out, because Steve only knew how to go flat out. And I said, but I'm having a problem getting it into gear because my clutch is going. So I tried to start it with it in gear. Almost had to push start it anyway. Somehow I got it started. So I carried on after him. And I just was on the way back doing 70 miles an hour. And suddenly the car ignited with the fuel that floated about in the cockpit because they were cars for the movie. And therefore, they weren't being really looked after the way they should.
Did you enjoy that? I mean, you were, I think, on set for 4 months. And we've just had F1, the movie, come out, which has been a huge success around the world. Brad Pitt proved to the world that he can drive. He tested the McLaren in Austin and did a load of mileage in an F2 car.
Yeah.
You say McQueen was flat out, proper driver?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, could have been a pro?
I didn't know he'd done so much racing. He raced Austin Healey's and God knows what else back in America. He was very good. When you think that he came on there, to me, he was just an actor. And he was a bloody good driver. I mean, he couldn't do what he couldn't handle it the way we did. I mean, there was several times he complained, and he said, well, you took it flat through that corner. He was behind me. I was in the Ferrari 512, and he was in the Porsche 917. Behind that was Seppert, and we go through the White House, and on this one lap, I thought, oh, I'm just going to take it flat. So I took the second part flat, and we got to the end about 300-400 yards away. Turned around. And he leapt out of the car, and John Sturgis was there, and he said, what the hell's wrong with you, Steve? He said, this bloody lunatic took me through the corner flat out. So he looked at me and said, did you go through flat out? I said, yes, but he didn't have to come with me.
You don't have to be flat.
It doesn't have to be flat.
Did you think of that movie, just finally? Did you like Le Mans?
Yeah, I did. I did. I was disappointed it didn't perhaps have a real story to it. But the fact was, that is a wonderful record of cars that raced in the 1970s.
And everyone tells me that you and McQueen were quite matey.
Oh, yeah. I went to see him in Hollywood and stuff like that. He wrote to me 3 weeks before he died, you know. I got a letter from him saying that he'd been ill and that sort of thing. I never bothered to follow it back. And I didn't think he was that ill. It was amazing, really. I got on with him. So I liked him a lot. But, you know, you drift apart after a couple of years. No, he actually wrote to me twice, and they had both letters for a while, and then suddenly they get lost. I had a car shop in Bognor, and motor accessory shop, and I remember opening his letters up. And in fact, Mike Earle was sitting there over there earlier. He he said, how are those letters from Steve McQueen? Or they've come in from LA or something. It was astonishing. And then I actually went visited him with my wife in Hollywood. And we went out to dinner and we went to a place called La Ferme de Michel, something like that. And he was with his then wife, Ally McGraw. He just married her.
I'm guessing when you go out to dinner with Steve McQueen, you're not inconspicuous, are you?
No. But people didn't bother him at all.
Well, Derek, it has been a wonderful chat. Movie star, Formula One driver, huge success in sports cars. Thank you so much for your time.
No, pleasure, mate.
And if I could just do one final thing, and it's the question I'm asking everyone on the pod this year, which is, Formula One is 75 years old this year. Can I ask you for one moment or memory in all 75 years that impressed you, means something to you? Doesn't have to be about your career. It could be Senna, Prost. It could be Jackie.
I've never been asked that before, but suddenly you go, I can't think about it. The trouble is, when you're putting that to me after all that lot, I'm going, there's so many occasions that must spring to mind of the racing that you saw or followed. And to say that was a brilliant race. I mean, it's funny, I follow tennis a lot, and I see that young,
Alcaraz.
Upon Alcaraz. He's so outrageously talented. But I couldn't tell you which is the most exciting part. But if he was in a car, he would be the one I would follow. I was a Senna fan, but not as much as probably I should have been because I didn't follow Formula One that much. But I do think to see Verstappen pick the car up and take it on a fastest lap in qualifying is absolutely amazing. He does something that I've never seen. I followed him very strongly without really talking about it. And then you suddenly find actually everybody else is seeing what I'm seeing. So it's not just me. You could say it was like Beloff's lap round Nürburgring, but he crashed in the end. So they can't really use that as a thing. But I think Verstappen's control knows how to do it, the calm and cool, collected way that he picks the car up and drives it. I didn't see the race on Sunday, but he must have driven very well.
He was relentless. You're talking about the Italian Grand Prix, and it was just 0.2 every lap, 0.2, 0.2, 0.2, and wins the race by 19.
That, to me, is spectacular. And, I mean, to me, I'm full of admiration for the way he drives. And it's not because I'm on the bandwagon of I love Verstappen. I've said to people, what do you want about? I said, you just watch that guy. He's got so much talent. Because the way he does it, I said, just watch him now, the last lap of qualifying. The car just seems to lift up and go. It has something about it. And now people like your good self are really talking about the fact that that was spectacular. We saw something quite special there.
Yeah. It's a real privilege to watch him. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, Derek, been a privilege. It's been a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. Verstappen's record speaks for itself, doesn't it? I love it when the stars of yesteryear pick out a current driver when reflecting on the greats in history. People like Derek have witnessed so much in this wonderful sport, and clearly he still loves watching today's champions getting the job done. Well, what a conversation with Derek. What a remarkable career. I loved hearing about his experiences at Ferrari and with Enzo. That anecdote about Enzo asking after the health of Derek's wife shows a tender side to the old man that you rarely hear about. And to talk to him about those great teammates he raced with at Le Mans was a joy. Although there was some sadness, him wishing he'd asked Stefan Beloff to slow down a bit was very moving to hear. What a life in motorsport, Derek. Thank you for sharing some stories, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this week. A couple of parish notices before I go. F1 Nation's preview of the Singapore Grand Prix is out now with myself and Jolyon Palmer. And F1 Explains meets the driver and doctor team on board the FIA's F1 medical car. Just search for F1 Nation and F1 Explains on your podcast app. Thanks very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.